underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Mark Lehner is the author of My Cousin, My Gastroenterologist, Tooth Imprints on a Corn Dog, I Smell Esther Williams, A2 Babe, and The Sugar Frosted Nutsack. He has written scripts for a variety of films and television shows. His new novel is Gone with the Mind. It is a novel in which a character named Mark Lehner is to give a reading of his new autobiography, also called Gone with the Mind, in a mall food court. In fact, it is the food court reading series curated by Mark Lehner's mother, Muriel. Recounting various chapters in his life, from the birth of his daughter to his battle with prostate cancer, Lehner offers soul and wisdom in a suburban mall. It is a great pleasure to welcome Mark Lehner to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, it's a great pleasure being here.
I have been a fan of your work for a long time. The first Mark Lehner novel I ever read was My Cousin, My Gastroenterologist, and I felt as though my world had changed in some way. What is it that brought you to want to write this type of novel, a autobiographical fiction, and really it's sort of a book in its own category, which I guess describes much of your work?
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One, starting with the last thing you said, I really try to wait between books until I have, hopefully, an idea of a kind of book that I haven't seen before, that I haven't read before. So when you said it's a book of its own kind, that's very important to me. I think there are writers who are very happy to sort of ply their craft in novel after novel and cover all kinds of subject matter, et cetera, and apply a certain sensibility in various ways to different subject matter. But I really try, and I think this is true since I started, to think of each book as an opportunity to make a new kind of book in some way or another. I don't know if I always succeed in that, but that's aspirational. The other thing is that for all of my career, I would say, certainly the books you mentioned before, kindly enough, if I used myself as a character, quote unquote, interesting word in these days of sort of reality, you know, reality TV, are those people characters? Are they, what are they?
Actually, are they real? You know, right.
Yeah. Which is something this book sort of, not sort of, something this book deals with. I had always avoided previously using myself in any kind of empirically verifiable way, a phrase I use in this book a lot. The Mark Lehners and other books, if I use that term, were very, what's a good way of saying, very hyperbolic versions of me. I mean, exaggerated to the point of really almost being the complete opposite of what I'm really like. And I had kind of put this total embargo on using real autobiographical information out of, I don't know what, to tell you the truth. Some sensitivity about it, maybe thinking it would be too sentimental, or maybe just thinking I was too ordinary, boring. I was too boring. Perhaps that was my fear. I don't know. I don't know really, but I do know that I really shied away from it. I mean, avoided it in a fairly militant, total way. And I decided with this book to embrace it, as they say.
So that old adage of write what you know,
I abided by the inverse.
Okay.
Write what you don't know. I was very loyal to some idea of a kind of pure imagination. That sounds like the lyric from a Willy Wonka song.
Yeah,
I think it is.
Pure imagination.
Great movie. And here I really changed horses completely in that way.
Were you comfortable with that?
Yes, I think it took a while to be comfortable with it. First of all, I made certain rules. I mean, I'm very unlike, I think, a lot of writers who finally write a kind of memoir or autobiography, in that this is going to sound so unlike me to anyone who's read any of my books, but I wanted to be consistently, unerringly kind and generous in my portrayal of other people. I just wanted the book to be a very compassionate, generous, understanding book when it came to other people in my life. So I was very scrupulous about that and careful about that. And I was unsparing and merciless and unkind to myself in the book. A masochist. A self-loathing, self-lacerating masochist.
That certainly is true of the compassion when it comes to your mother, who is introducing you at the book reading and takes up the first quarter or fifth of the book.
That's only because I stopped her. She would have taken over the whole book, the entire book. There would be no room left for me, as is frequently the case in conversations with my mom. Is an epic talker. She's one of the great talkers. I mean, I've heard about great talkers all my life. Oscar Wilde was apparently pretty world class, and my mom is. I mean, not only in terms of volume and kind of pathological endurance, but in how she speaks and what she says. Great talker.
In telling the story and in the introduction, she's telling about you, but she's also very much telling about herself.
Unlike any of my other books, this is another very significant difference. I had a very carefully preconceived structure for this book. So I knew the book was going to be in the form of a reading. So a reading is basically three parts. Someone introduces the reader reads, and there's a Q&A. When I came upon that structure, as prosaic as that sounds, I was convinced that that was going to be a kind of beautiful, fertile, amazing kind of structure to do what I thought I might do with it. It doesn't sound like it at first. And I had this idea that my mother would introduce me and that that would sort of transmogrify itself into something else entirely, that it would cease to be about me and become about her.
That structure certainly could have been more staid if it was in a Barnes & Noble or an independent bookstore in the city.
Right.
But it's in a food court in a mall.
Right.
It's during a storm. And there's just some employees walking around.
Right.
That makes it, A, humorous, but B, also you're fighting the crowd a little bit, or lack thereof.
Lack thereof. Well, I have a redundant system of impediments to anyone being there. Not only is it an unlikely nonfiction at the food court series, which no one would come to anyway. But just to make sure there's no one there, I made a storm. I mean, with flood warnings and all sort of torrential rains and flood warnings and whatnot, to make sure absolutely no one would be there. And obviously, according to the book, I'm not particularly popular. No one comes. And my mother has to drive me. I mean, which says something about how, you know, how prosperous and successful this writer is, if he has to depend on his mom. At the age of 60, his mom being in her 80s, that the two of them have to drag themselves to this mall to a reading that no one attends.
Mark Lehner is our guest in this week's book show. The name of the book is Gone with the Mind. Was it difficult for you at all, a challenge at all, to write compassionately?
No, not at all, because as I said, I mean, I say this with all humility, but I tend to be, I think, a pretty sweet, in fact, sappy person. I can cry at a, you know, hair replacement commercial or something. I'm easily moved. That may be a personal cross to bear. I don't know. But it's an interesting question on an aesthetic, literary level, too, as well as on a personal level. I discovered that, I mean, I had suspected this for a long time. If one is going to look back at one's life, I think the excavation of that life is much deeper if the writer has a kind of loving remembrance of things. I mean, I think if you look back at your life in a resentful, embittered way, it closes off so many avenues of retrospection, I think, or obstructs them. So I found that trying to maintain a level of sweetness and compassion sort of blew open the past in ways that I wouldn't have otherwise, if I had taken a more kind of jaundiced retrospection.
With Mark Lehner being a character in the book, it it leaves us, the reader, of course, wondering how much of this is this character's story and how much of it is your story. Do you want that? Do you like that idea?
I like the idea because I think it's illuminating the way we fabricate ourselves, represent ourselves to each other. I mean, we do all sorts of theatrical things in the ways we present ourselves, even in intimate situations, and to strangers, and to coworkers, and to family. There's a dramaturgy to the way we are, I think, and the way in which we make audiences out of each other, which is one of the themes of this book. It's about my mother and I acting as each other's audience, and my trying to enlist these poor two guys who work for Panda Express as an audience. They so don't want to be, you know. It's always an indeterminate issue to some degree. I mean, how real a person is in that person's presentation of him or herself in life, in books, in nonfiction, in fiction. In this book, though, I have to say, I mean, I can say now with absolute candor and certainty, everything I say that happened to me happened to me. If not, I say not. I mean, there's a character in the book, the imaginary intern, mm-hmm. who is imaginary. Right. That's why he's called the imaginary intern. I mean, I do really take great, again, scrupulous care to be, in a way, non-fictional, to honor this funny idea of the nonfiction at the food court series. The premise is fictional, and the idea of being driven by my mother and being introduced by my mother and doing the whole reading at the food court, it's all a fictional construct. But the vignettes and anecdotes I tell about my life are from my life, at least to the degree I remember them and in the manner in which I remember them.
Was there ever a thought to say, I would just like to write a memoir?
You know, I think a lot of decisions I make are based on my initial feeling of, you know, that sounds like an awful lot of work. That doesn't sound like any fun. I mean, starting back in my childhood and working my way up through grade school, junior high, all of that. And, you know, there's a kind of arduous, methodical process involved in that makes me think, nah. In fact, I think there's a conversation like that in the book where the imaginary intern says to me, you don't want to do that. That very question comes up. See, you could be a very good character in this book.
I would love to be a character in
well,
this book.
Next. There are more books.
The idea of telling the story in such a, and this is true for all of your work, in the comedic and satirical sense, the way that you have done that over the years. The short way of asking this question is, what are the challenges of writing funny? Because I've heard this from a number of writers. You have that voice, and then as you fine-tune it and you go through it and you edit it, that you can often lose that. But you don't seem to do that. There is a tone. How have you been able to perfect that and get it to a point where it is a voice that you enjoy?
I may have perfected it by, to some degree, ignoring it. I got a wonderful award last year from the Paris Review for humor. It's called the Terry Southern Award. Mm-hmm. And I said in my very brief remarks upon being presented with this award that I really think humor is a kind of secondary effect. I'm not sitting there trying to be funny. I mean, I know it's a constant secondary effect. I'm not a kind of naive idiot savant where people laugh and I don't understand why they're laughing. But the things that people find funny, I initially find, let's just use the word for lack of a better one, right now, interesting. I mean, if two disparate things are juxtaposed in a way I find interesting or novel or perhaps unprecedented, mm-hmm. these two maybe registers of speech or these two kinds of anecdotes or a character put in a certain milieu, whatever the juxtaposition is, I'll find sort of fascinating. And typically, a reader will find that funny, I have found, over the years. The effect in the end is humorous. The initial procedure is not necessarily to make something funny.
So when you think of robot rape,
yes,
then where do you go from there?
You think that's funny? No, I'm kidding you. I had a prostatectomy, a robot, or it was robot assisted. Now, I don't know quite what that means because I wasn't awake.
Right.
I don't know how active the robot was or really what happened completely. But it did seem to me a possibility that if there are robots capable of doing prostatectomies, what if they got loose and all gathered somewhere? I mean, communicated with each other and decided, oh, let's all meet in Paramus, New Jersey and have a night of it. We'll just tear out some tear out a bunch of prostates. And then we'll all go back and go back to sleep at our various hospitals and no one will know the better. I thought that without thinking, oh, isn't that funny? Now, of course, retrospectively or watching other people read it or hear it, I mean, yes, it's funny.
But at the root of it...
Now, at the root of it are other issues.
But there's also a plausibility.
Yes, there's a plausibility. Well, I have a feeling. I don't want to attempt any kind of grand theory of comedy, but I have a feeling that plausibility is to some degree crucial to a certain kind of humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just say something to someone and it could never happen, it doesn't land in quite that way as something that may be possible. The fear that we all have now that somehow our appliances will all band together and kill us, you know, because everything is smart now. So our toothbrush will somehow communicate with our coffee maker and they'll all decide, let's kill them. Let's kill the two people in the bed. Which is it's a fear, right? That all these things will revolt against us somehow. That's part of this. I mean, when we talk about humor, we're also talking about anxiety. And I mean, I do have I said I wouldn't give a grand theory of humor, but I do think humor is a way that people have of consensually acknowledging how absolutely miserably, abjectly difficult life is, how almost impossibly hard it is to try to be a dignified person through the profound indignities of this life, and that expressing that to each other in various ways constitutes, that's sort of the heart of humor. It's a kind of shared acknowledgement of that.
The first time I read the novel, I was able to just enjoy it and have a great time with it, as I do with all of your work. And then I got this interview and I went back and reread parts of it. And the idea of just that nonfiction writer series in a food court. And the first thing as I was rereading it, which did not occur to me the first time I read it, but it did the second, I wonder if there's a publicist somewhere that's trying to put Mark into a food court to do a book reading for this book.
Somehow I hope that that happens. But I have a feeling that if I did a reading of this book, if I did a reading of a book about me doing a reading at a food court, if I did that reading at the food court, I think it would create some sort of a cosmic aperture that would just suck me into it. Because the sort of conceptual Mobius strip that would be, and vortex that would be created by doing that would be so powerful, I'd never be seen again. That would be a great way to go. It's sort of like going up being sucked up the ass of one's own literary aspirations.
A beautiful way of putting it. Really is. What did Mom make of the book?
I was nervous. Because I spoke to my mom, I recorded her, I got a lot of the material from her. I mean, a lot of that first section of her introduction is my mom talking about her life, her pregnancy, what it was like to be a pregnant woman in the mid to late 50s, and tricked her in a way. I didn't tell her, this is going to be you introducing me. I just said, talk about being pregnant with me. Because transposing that into a so-called introduction is the humor, the one of the comic things, and it wouldn't work if I had told her to try to do that. And then time passed, and you know, it's one thing to say something, and it's another thing to read it in a book, and then have all kinds of misgivings, like I don't really want that in a book. I shouldn't have said that about so and so, and you know. So I was nervous when my mother was going to read. First of all, things she had said. I had no worries about what I had said about my mom or the way she's portrayed in the book because, as I said, I think it's an extremely intentionally loving portrait of what is in reality a very loving relationship. I haven't been concerned about what people will think of their portrayal in this book because it's First of all, it's accurate. No one can sue me. It's the truth. Bring it on. I secretly tape everyone. No, that's not true. I didn't lie about anyone or put words in people's mouths or anything like that. So I wasn't concerned about that.
Were you ultimately pleased with your level of artistic and literary success?
I don't know. The way you pose that question makes me wonder if I should be. It's like talking to a doctor.
It struck
just
me.
Just tell me, I'm not going to make it, right?
It struck me.
Be honest.
When I first came to your work and I started reading your work, and I loved it, and it's as if like you were writing for me. And then, like I see on Letterman.
Right.
And that seems like a rarity for a writer to have a moment like that.
I think I've seen this mutate sort of wildly in my own life. It's not only the contingencies of my career personally, but I think just of perhaps the status of the writer in our culture. Because when I first started doing this, all I wanted, and I think almost any writer you would ever talk to would say something similar to this. You start and all you think is, if someday I could just see something of mine in a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Even in back in those days, I don't care. It could be some mimeographed thing. I don't even think that word exists anymore, mimeographed. You know, and then your aspirations maybe become a little bolder, and you think, I could be in a magazine, an actual magazine someday, and I'll be happy with that. It's like you're making deals with the supreme being. Just give me that, and then you can give me leprosy and carbuncles or anything. I'll take it. Just one thing. And then you think, a book, one book, a little book, maybe even a little book of poetry that no one will ever see or buy or no one will read, but I'll just go to a bookstore one day and I'll see it there. I'll go back in the poetry section. I'll see it there. That's all, you know, please. I'll never ask for anything again. So that was me then. I mean, I love doing this work. I was always very interested in seeing how language, prose could be turned into some kind of, you know, I use this word shamelessly, some kind of art form that I hadn't quite seen before, but very, very kind of low aspirations for any kind of career, quote unquote. Then this thing happened where, as you said, I was on Letterman and Conan and different things like that, and it was really mind-boggling, and I'm not quite sure how all that happened. I mean, I think some of it was because this work came out at a time during which there were people in various entertainment sectors of the culture that were sort of sympathetic to what I was doing, or who knows, or I had a great publicist, or, I mean, really, there are things that determine why things like this happen that have very little to do, perhaps, with the value of the work. But I remember being on Conan O'Brien's show once, and he said, why don't you just read something? We'll put a funny podium up, and you just read something as if you were just at some, like, beatnik cafe or something. And then I read what I was working on, and I thought, as I'm reading it, isn't this amazing? I mean, I'm on a television show, and I'm just reading this sort of unhinged kind of work on television. How did this happen? So it was very extraordinary and maybe disturbed me a little. I mean, it was a sort of hard thing. I don't know. It couldn't have made me into a better person. It was horrible to be with then. Because
Does it sell books?
You buy it to a certain extent. I don't think so. I used to think this. I think Gone with the Mind is the most enjoyable, accessible book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I say enjoyable, I mean in an accessible way, like sort of page by page, sentence by sentence that I've ever done. It's sort of almost another species of books. But I used to think to a degree that the more people knew about my books, the less likely they would be to want to read them. So if I'm reading something on TV, I'm saying, uh-oh, this is killing it. I mean, really killing it. I mean, killing it in both ways. But I'm being hard on myself. To finish this whole line of thinking, you know, that sort of ended. I mean, writers stopped being on shows like that. So that level of notoriety that I had then very much subsided until I wrote the book before this, The Sugar Frosted Nutsack, and then this. And now, you know, people are talking about my work again. So I've seen it all. The heights and the valleys, and then the heights again.
Mark Lander's new book is Gone with the Mind. It's published by Little Brown. Mark, a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. This was a really fun conversation. They're not all fun.
Thank you.
I can assure you.
Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Special thanks to Paul Ruest and Argo Studios. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.